I call this meeting of the House Housing Finance and Policy Committee to order. Let it be known that we have quorum. So welcome to committee, everybody. We have a great agenda today. We're going to be hearing from the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. But before we get into that, I think it would be good for us to all go through introductions again. So we'll start here, and then we'll go to my left, and then we'll go into staff after that. So welcome, everyone. Chair Representative Spencer Igo. I represent half of the Iron Range. Hand it off to you.
Glad to be here. I'm Representative Mike Howard. I'm the lead for the Housing Committee for the DFL Caucus, representing Richfield and a slice of South Minneapolis.
Hello, everybody. Rep. Leish Kozlowski, and I represent Duluth, Minnesota. I was going to say the greatest part of greater Minnesota.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Representative Matt Norris. I represent the Blaine and Lexington area in the North Metro.
Hi, everyone. Esther Agbadre. I represent a district in North Minneapolis and parts of downtown Minneapolis.
Hello, this is Representative Hussein, and welcome in District 65A. And this is my second term in being in housing.
Good afternoon. Representative Hulda Hiltzley, representing the best district in the whole entire state of Minnesota. Just going to put it out there. Brooklyn Park Inacio. Thank you.
Hello, good afternoon. I'm Representative Carrie Ray Rauer, representing 35B, eastern half of Coon Rapids and two precincts of Andover.
There you go. Representative Mecklen, I represent the fine cities of Becker and Big Lake, and Representative Howard failed to mention that he is a fine Becker graduate.
Andrew Myers, second term, and second term on housing here. I represent 11 cities in the western portion of Hennepin County.
Wayne Johnson, 41A, and I think, Huda, you mistaken, and you forgot to say Cottage Grove, Lake Elmo, didn't you? First term, excited to be on housing. Thank you.
I'm Representative Jim Nash. I represent District 48A, which is Central Carver County. This is my sixth term here, second time on housing, and happy to be here.
Representative Jeff Dotseth, House Seat 11A, which is actually all of Carlton County, Northern Pines, Southern St. Louis. It's an honor to be back on housing again this year.
All right, thank you, members. And we're talking about who's got the best. Remember, I'm from the range, so like we can just leave that aside. We'll hand off. We'll go to our committee administrator for staff and work with our staff now.
Yeah, hi, my name is Garrick Spellman. I'm the committee administrator, and I'm looking forward to working with everybody. So.
Betsy Ritzer, committee legislative assistant.
I'm Molly Peterson, and I'm House DFL Research.
Benji Brinks, DFL committee administrator.
Hi, Samia Cannon, DFL CLA.
Luke LeBron, GOP Research.
Thank you, everyone. Also, notice our wonderful pages in the room. Joan Ping, thank you for being with us today and for the rest of this committee. So with that, we'll move then right into our next agenda item, where we're going to have an agency overview today. So welcome to committee, Commissioner Ho.
This one is always live, is that right? Yes, no buttons to push. Chair Igo and members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Ho, and this is my seventh session as the Commissioner of Minnesota Housing. Very excited to be here. Very excited for those of you who are returning to the committee, and very much looking forward to meeting those of you who are new. I just in terms of like a second about who I am, I grew up in Fridley. My first job really was in managed care. I worked in Medicaid and Medicare managed care for 10 years. It was in that work that I was brought into the conversation about the health of people experiencing homelessness, and I've worked for the last 25 years in various capacities on trying to solve the problem of homelessness. And that is how I came to become, I guess, the head of the State Housing Finance Agency. I'm here today with Dan Kitzberger, who is my legislative director. As I was telling Representative Johnson, all the hard questions should go to Dan. And Amanda Welliver is behind us here as well. We are the friendly faces that you'll see, and again, reach out about anything. And I'm looking forward to getting some one-on-one time with you and just as it fits within your schedule. I'm happy to be over here or happy to meet you, however it's going to be convenient most to you. I also just have been so excited to be able to meet Chair Igo and sit with you and experience your passion for these issues of housing. So very excited to have you in this role and have your leadership. Doesn't matter which great district you represent. I know that wherever I travel all across the state, everybody tells me that we need more housing. And that the housing shortage is impacting families, it's impacting businesses, it's impacting seniors, it's impacting kids in school, it's impacting really how we're doing as an economy in Minnesota. So I look forward to working together on that. So with that, I have quite a few slides because I was asked to kind of do both an overview of Minnesota housing as well as just an update in terms of where we are in terms of the investments that the legislature made in 23 and 24. And I'll defer to you, Chair, in terms of should we take questions as we go or should we go all the way through? I'm going to just start by talking about our mission. You know, we really believe that housing is foundational to a full life and a thriving state. So we equitably collaborate with individuals, with communities, and with partners to create, preserve, and finance housing that's affordable. I tend, when I'm in front of a crowd, to say nobody wants housing that's not affordable. It's just that we can all afford different levels of housing, and increasingly the housing supply that's out there is out of reach for many, many households. We were created in 1971. We're somewhat of a unique creature inside of state government. I have an independent board of directors that includes the state auditor. We have an annual independent financial audit. We don't use direct appropriations for agency operating costs. Over here, I run a bank. And we have earnings on loans that we do on the bank, and that has allowed us to pay for the vast majority of our agency operating costs. And, of course, we work statewide. So really, think of us as a mission-driven financial institution. We issue bonds in the bond market. We have federal authority to do that. And so we work with the ratings agencies, Moody's and Standard & Poor's. I like to say that we're the best housing finance agency in the country, and it's not just because I think so. It's because the people at Moody's and Standard & Poor's, who look at all the state housing finance agencies, give me that positive reinforcement on a regular basis. We're one of the leading state housing finance agencies in terms of our homeownership lending production. We hit above our weight in terms of just what we're able to do. And, you know, the reinvestment of what we earn on the bank side into the mission is one of the things that I think that makes our work special together. My relationship with you is the envy of many of my peers around the country who do not enjoy state-appropriated dollars to add to what their federal directives are. And so very, very grateful to this partnership with you and what we're able to do and able to reach deeper in order to do work on homelessness and other things that a housing finance agency that's just a standard loan agency without a relationship with their legislature is able to do. The fact that we're able to issue bonds is part of what allows us to do lending to reach home buyers who wouldn't be served by the private market. And we represent about 8% of the mortgage lending industry across the state. That's actually increased a couple percentage points since I began. So we're an important part of what is largely a private sector business. We work in housing across the full continuum. And I think it's important to understand that everything from homelessness to home ownership and home improvement, that all of that is in our toolbox. We do support the financing of new construction. We support the financing of preservation deals. And, you know, we help young families that are just starting out with an affordable mortgage loan and a boost from down payment assistance. That's been a core part of what we've done for a long time. That's equally important to focus just a moment on what we are not. We are not a builder. We are not a developer. We don't own any properties like some public housing agencies or others might own properties. We don't regulate the housing market or the development market. We don't mediate landlord-tenant disputes. We don't help people find housing, but we help the organizations that do that help. We don't set or enforce local housing, zoning, or land use policies. We don't run the HUD voucher program. We are, however, the administrator of the HUD private market project-based Section 8 program. When I think about our agency, I really think of us as having four programmatic divisions. So our single-family division, our multifamily division, our housing stability division, and our newest local government housing programs division. We used to just have the single-family and the multifamily division, and the housing stability division was a subset of multifamily. But what we've really seen is that as that work on housing stability has grown, that we wanted to elevate it to its own division. And then as a result of the investments from the 2023 legislative session, we had a bunch of new line items that didn't work the same way as our traditional programs did. And it was really about having relationships with cities and counties and tribes directly. So we stood up this new local government housing programs team to do that. Everything that we do, we really do through partnerships, whether that's with a lending network of folks that are offering the mortgages directly to end users, whether it's the developer who is acquiring or constructing a new building, a network of counselors who help people understand, am I ready to buy a home? What does it mean to buy a home? And can also do foreclosure prevention work. You know, we'd actually have a huge development community here. It's both nonprofits and for-profits that we work with. And we're there to help them put together the financing of those deals. We work with community action programs. We work with counties. We work with just a ton of community organizations all across the state. We work with public housing authorities. We work with housing and redevelopment authorities, and we work with local governments. So what we do is that we provide the funds, we provide the resources, oftentimes through competitive RFPs. And then I think that it's important that a lot of Minnesotans use our products or benefit from what we do, but their relationship is with somebody else who's made it possible for them. A little bit by the numbers now. In federal fiscal year 2024, we had $1.96 billion in total expenditures and helped more than 73,000 households. Our largest line item is what I do over here on the bank, $1.2 billion of mortgage financing. And then the second biggest line item is our federal administration of these rental assistance contracts with the private market, that $256 million. And then you can see how everything else plays out relative to those two biggest programs. You might note we've got the tail on some of the COVID-19 emergency assistance dollars that we got from the feds that stand out there. But a whole range of things that we've done. That little category of other at the bottom, just for folks who are curious, that's some disaster recovery work that we do. It's the housing mediation grant program. I know Community Mediation Minnesota is here today. It's technical assistance and capacity building. As I mentioned, most of the funding that we do is through a competitive RFP and grant processes. You know, oftentimes a developer, say, of a senior apartment building, they're going to have to put together what we call a capital stack, a range of funding from different sources in order to make the deal come together. So a lot of times we're a part of funding. I also allocate low-income housing tax credits The federal low-income housing tax credit is actually one of the largest sources of capital for the production and preservation of affordable housing. I think the other thing that's important, because I think we'll probably talk about like funds that are committed, funds that are out the door, because a lot of what we fund is the construction or rehabilitation of buildings, there's the moment at which we decide which projects are going to get funding, but oftentimes a year, maybe even 18 months pass by before that developer has all their financing and is ready to close on financing and put a shovel in the ground. And then once construction starts, they draw funds over the period of construction on that project in different ways. So the way that I think about committed and obligated, we should always make sure that we're using the same sense of the word when we begin talking about that, because we have oftentimes told a developer, you're going to get this money, and but it's still sitting in our bank account, not theirs. And so I just want to make sure that we have the opportunity to walk through that. And then also, I mentioned that we have a board of directors. My staff makes recommendations to the board for which projects we should fund, which loans we should do, which grants we should be making. And so that's another step along the way for us getting funds committed. Just want to give you an idea. This is, you'll see lots of maps from us. We spend a lot of time putting dots on maps to understand where in the state is our funding going. And geographic distribution is really important to us. I can't fund a project that doesn't come in and ask for funding. So there are certain parts of the state where we don't get as many funding. We don't have as many opportunities to put a dot on the map. But it is something that's really important in terms of our paying attention to what we do. So if you take a look at our consolidated request for proposal selections process from 2023, there's a multifamily component, there's a single family component, and there's a manufactured home community component. So in 2023 in total, we selected for $348 million worth of projects. In home ownership, it was the largest ever, nearly $110 million and 1,300 home ownership opportunities. 46% of the projects that we selected served Greater Minnesota. On the rental side, the multifamily side, it was nearly $150 million in state resources, which included housing infrastructure appropriations, I think, in 2023, the Challenge Fund and PARIF, the Preservation of Affordable Rental Investment Fund dollars. 54% of the projects were in Greater Minnesota. Unfortunately, even though it was a year where we had more resources than ever, I am always in a position where I say yes to some projects, but sadly, I say more to no. And I always say to folks, it's not that I'm dividing between these projects are good and these projects aren't good. I would love to do the vast majority of them. It's just about the availability of resources. So even in 2023, where we had more resources than ever, we were still saying no to over two-thirds of the applications that came in the door. And then in manufactured housing in 2023, that was by far our largest ever. The agency's only been investing in manufactured home communities. During my tenure, it was newer for us, but we funded 19 communities with $21.5 million. So if you take a look at it all combined, 55% of the funding went into the metro area and 45% of the funding went into Greater Minnesota. And this doesn't cover all of our programs, just the programs that flow through our consolidated RFPs. So in addition, we have the Greater Minnesota Workforce Housing Development Program and other programs that I'll speak about more specifically as I go ahead. So if you compare 2023 to 2024, we did $348 million in 2023. In 2024, we did $191 million. So a lot of the 2020, one of the things that's unique about our process is that my annual funding process starts while you're in session and grant applications are due after you're finished. So I can actually connect what you decide to invest at the end of session to projects that same calendar year. That's left for a bit of a cliffhanger in years where business was done on a different timetable, like the October bonding bill. But even with the October bonding bill, we were able to match that available resource to projects in selections that year. But you can see again the ways in which the numbers split up between homeownership, rental, and manufactured housing just this last December. If you take a look at from 2020 through 2024, the dots on the map, you can begin to see you know, how this begins to amass all across the state in terms of where we're able to put dots on the map. So I think the most important thing, the takeaway here, is that when you invest in Minnesota housing, we are investing in communities across the state. These are programs that create and preserve housing and create stability for people in your districts and all across the state. Last year, 48% of the funding in the went to projects in greater Minnesota. And over the last 3 years, about 47% of competitive dollars went to greater Minnesota. So again, that's something we're very, very mindful of when we make selections. I think that's good for that page.
Commissioner?
So the chair asked...
I was just wondering, I wonder if this was maybe a good break spot for us, see if there's any questions from the committee here on some of this programming before we continue, just break it up a little bit. If there's any questions from members of the committee. All right, you must be doing a really good job. There you go. You can continue. Thank you.
I'll take silence as praise, Chair. Thank you. So the 2023-2024 funding, I just wanted to kind of give a high-level overview, especially for those of you who are new to the committee. In 2023, the legislature more than doubled the number of programs that Minnesota Housing administers, which I think is really important to note because new things are harder to do than putting money through existing clockworks. And so there's been a lot of standing up of new that we've been engaged in since the 2023 session. This is a list of, in the first column, the programs that we had going into the 2023 legislative session. Second column were the new programs that were created in the 2023 session, as well as an additional program that was created in the 2024 session. The third column were 2023 legislatively named grantees. And then at the bottom, the legislatively named grantees from 2024. And then just an FYI, other new things that we were doing at the same time in the fourth column. So when you take a look at, like, where are we in terms of moving money out the door or selecting projects through all of these programs, things that have been selections approved or the funds have been dispersed. A great example of that is the Agency First Generation Down Payment Assistance Program. Funded in 23, stood up in 24, closed down in 24. So we're just in kind of a closeout period now in terms of the impact of that. The Greater Minnesota Workforce Housing Program, $39 million, much bigger than it had ever been. We got the first distribution of public housing rehab, some capacity building grants. We're also running the State Housing Tax Credit and Contribution Fund, a first year of operation with that program. We have, this is just, you know, for example, not meant to be everything. We've recently closed RFPs for the last tranche of family homeless prevention money from those 2 years. Homework starts with home. And we actually had a high-rise sprinkler system program that we're going to come to you with in our technical amendments because we found when we did the RFP that a lot of the applicants, the eligibility criteria around building height and income of people who live there made it so that very few buildings actually were eligible when we did the RFP. So we want to talk more about that later. Some upcoming funding opportunities. What's today? The 11th. The Local Housing Trust Fund a program, RFP, is opening tomorrow. Greater Minnesota Tier 2 Cities, we have an intent to apply that's open and an RFP that's coming momentarily. Bring It Home Rental Assistance, RFP momentarily. Greater Minnesota Infrastructure Program, Roads and Sewers, something we've never done before, coming in March. Community Stabilization, RFP, we think that we'll have that out in April. Currently have RFPs open for homeownership investment grants, public housing round two, and a special carve-out of challenge funds going to schools. I just as a point of interest, last week on the local housing trust fund, we received 60 responses in the intent to apply, requesting $11.1 million out of the $5.8 million that's available. So I think one of the phrases you'll hear from me a lot this session is these programs are all oversubscribed. By and large, there's more need out there than even the funding that we got in 2023. Take a look at it from the perspective of some bar graphs. The first bar is of all resources, what has been committed. And then, where are we making good progress is the green. But if you take a look at existing programs versus new programs versus named grantees, it was much easier for us to get funding committed where we had existing programs. It's been slower for us to get things done where we've had new programs. And we're making good progress on all those legislatively named grantees. So that's a lot of words and numbers. What I wanted to do is just bring forward for you some of the people that are impacted by these programs. When we did our annual funding announcements in December, it was a cold day. We were out in a tent outside of some buildings that had been owned by Perspectives. It was a nonprofit that went bankrupt in St. Louis Park last year. This was one of the residents. Her name is Corinne. And when they heard that the people that owned their buildings were in financial trouble, all the residents in those apartment buildings panicked. They were worried they were going to lose their homes. And they got a notice that the property was entering bankruptcy. And then kind of at a miraculous speed, not often seen in the housing market, an organization called Trellis was able to step in and purchase those buildings and offer reassurance to the residents that they weren't going to be displaced. This property received $8.6 million from the housing infrastructure bonds that allowed Trellis to not only, purchase the building, but really to invest in the building to make sure that the community had the quality of life that those residents deserved. Those housing infrastructure bonds and the housing infrastructure appropriations that you have done, it's really a unique Minnesota tool, an innovation here that other folks are envious of, but it allows us to do things like preserve this important community out in St. Louis Park. Another example, this is up from the Virginia HRA, just coincidentally from the range, Chair. This is a public housing property that was a part of the selections that we did in 2024. This is going to help preserve 1,641 apartments and townhomes across the whole state. 15 of the 18 projects that we selected were in greater Minnesota. And, the woman who runs the program up there just talking about what a critical piece of the community this public housing is. And one of the things I've observed as I've been able to travel across the state is oftentimes when you're in a small town, the high rise is a public housing building. Or the apartment complex that's subsidized is a USDA, U.S. Department of Agriculture, rural housing project. And so the importance of some of the most affordable rental housing in communities all across the state, our ability to go in and help those buildings be high quality, healthy, operating efficiency buildings in those communities is really, really important. The next slide, you're standing in a field in St. Cloud here. This is our Economic Development and Housing Challenge Program, affectionately referred to as Challenge. These are the folks from Dreamliner Estates in St. Cloud. And this was really interesting. I went up to St. Cloud and did a community housing meeting up at Centricare. And it was a cold day. I remember driving up the way that the snow blows sideways across the highway when you're on your way to St. Cloud. And you get into this this community room at Centricare, and it was just packed full of people from the region. And it was builders, and it was developers, and it was businesses, and it was elected leaders, and it was hospital folks and community members. But these guys here in the picture, like when it was time for me to go, like they chased me out into the hallway, and they're like, "We want to do this. We want to do this. We want to build housing in our community." And so, you know, it's exciting that they actually, in their first time in, were awarded $3.4 million from the Challenge Program, and they're going to create 16 single-family homes in two blocks of eight up in their community. And obviously, by building, you know, multiple homes at once, they're able to get some labor efficiencies and cost savings by doing that. But they're also putting people to work in their community. So they'll be targeting home buyers with incomes under 80% of area median income. Most of what we do in housing, area median income is the standard that we're using. And for a household of four in Sherburne County in 2024, that's $97,800. I mentioned our first-generation down payment assistance. This gentleman standing in front of his brand-new home is one of the first people to benefit from that program. We distributed $50 million in down payment assistance to support about 1,450 first-generation home buyers between last spring and the end of the year. The goal of the first-generation down payment assistance was to reach homebuyers of color and help close the homeownership gap that we have. 80% of the homebuyers that took advantage of that program identified as Black, Indigenous, or homebuyers of color. And then parallel to that, there's another program that's being operated by Midwest Minnesota CDC, and that program continues to operate and it is also finding great success in terms of reaching homebuyers of color across the state. Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that I think, you know, weighs on me every day, and I'm sure you hear it when you're door knocking or working with your constituents, is that this problem of the supply of housing being less than the number of households that we have in the state really has been persistent since the housing crash. During the housing crash, home production really dropped significantly, but the creation of new households in the state, it didn't go away. So I want to just talk a little bit about the impact of this. The shortage of housing, this is basic supply demand, right? I mean, this is stuff, you know, we learned in high school. When you've got a shortage, it's going to cost go up. In rental housing, it is harder to build new housing, and we're just not building enough. We're seeing that the eviction rates have remained high. Rents are increasing, and really they're outpacing incomes for people at the lowest end of the income spectrum. And the operators of affordable rental housing are finding that their operating costs are being driven by inflation, insurance costs, and other things like that. But they've agreed to have a predictable level of rent to keep the units affordable. So their operating expenses have gone up, but there's a limit to the increases that they do on rent. On the single family side, the home ownership disparities between white households and other households really remains egregious and persistent. It is harder and harder to become a first-time home buyer. And the supply is incredibly low, especially for homes under $300,000. I guess the idea that there's no new federal funding coming, I think, is probably something that we all understand. You know, I think we're also trying to understand where we use federal resources that may also we may not be able to be guaranteed in the future. You know, when interest rates stayed incredibly low for an extended period of time, I think it created this different set of expectations around home ownership. But now at 7%, I mean, the interest rates are really at what historically had been an average rate. In fact, the folks that worked for my agency 30 years ago remember when interest rates for buying a home were 18%. But I think what we have seen over the course of the last year when interest rates have resumed kind of a more normal level is that people still hope that they're going to be able to buy a house at 3.5%. Or somebody who's holding a mortgage at 3.5% who had been thinking about maybe buying something different don't want to give up the 3.5% mortgage that they have and take on a 7% interest rate. I mean, that makes perfect sense. I think that what we're anticipating people coming to terms with is the fact that we're not going to go back down to 3.5% anytime soon. So if they were waiting for that, it may not happen. And so people's calculus around whether or not they are involved in that, I think, could change over time. The other thing that we're seeing, and certainly the California wildfires have only exacerbated this, is that insurance costs are going up. Property and casualty insurance costs are going up all over the country. I had a chance to sit with Commissioner Arnold and some of the affordable housing operators during the not legislative session and just talk through the realities of that. And I think it's a combination that claims are up. We have more damage from hail than we had 10, 15, 20 years ago. And so claims are going up, but the costs are going up. And I think there's also some uneasiness about the cost of materials. One of the things that hindered construction in multifamily apartment buildings during the pandemic was supply chain issues. The building was built, but they were waiting on their appliances. I think people are concerned about the cost of lumber and the cost of steel and gypsum and other things like that. I'm not a builder, so don't ask me to. Dan can answer that. I think the next slide is really, the reason that Minnesota Housing targets our resources towards lower income renters and home buyers. If you take a look at folks who are cost burdened, which means that they pay more than they can afford, more than 30% of their income on housing, as you go down the income level, you see that more and more renters and homeowners are cost burdened by their housing, which means that they don't have the income that they need to pay for other necessities of life. So it puts pressure on everything. And this is another slide that I just found. I guess it gave me pause. I think I didn't quite realize this. But between 2019 and 2022, gross rent increased from $778 to $810. If you're taking a look at the bottom quarter of units in terms of who they serve relative to income. So at the same time that those rents increased 4.1%, the households living in that housing, their incomes decreased from $23,400 to $21,900. So the purchasing power of these lowest income renters is going down as well.
Maybe this is another good spot for a pause for questions here. Is there any questions from the committee? Representative Howard.
Thanks, Chair Igoe. Just a quick comment about those last few slides, especially about the housing shortage. And I just really want to underscore for us this slide here. I really think this slide here should guide a lot of our work in our housing committee this year. The reality is, whether we're talking to our renters or someone trying to afford a single family home, it costs too much. I think all of us understand that from the conversations we've had with our constituents, and that more and more folks feel like they're priced out of the kind of home that they want. And at the core of that is the reality we don't have enough homes. And so both from a policy perspective and from a public investment perspective, I really think this should really center our work this session on a bipartisan basis.
Being Representative Howard, next will be Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, good to see you. Thanks for being here. I wanted to talk about the last slide, and we've had this conversation before, and last year, 2 years ago, it all blurs together, there was a huge amount of money spent on housing. But I don't believe that the huge amount of money is available again, but even that did not necessarily change the supply of houses to the level that it needs to. What are some other things that you view as a possibility to create some relief for the creation of new homes, for the building of new homes?
Commissioner Hall.
Chair and Representative Nash, thanks for the question. First of all, just to remind you, this is a pig in a python, right? I mean, we've got money that's moving through the system, but not all of the units that are being produced with the 2023 investments are online yet. So we haven't seen the full benefit realized in markets around some of the things that we've invested in. So start there. And then the second thing is that I think we always knew, even when we made the big investments in 2023, that this wasn't something that was going to be solved with one-year, one-time investment. This is something that we're going to have to work our way at over a decade until we get balance in a healthy market between supply and demand. I will simply say we are very interested in the conversation that you all are having around zoning and land use, even though we do not participate in that type of regulation, but I certainly know that the governor is paying attention to the conversations that you're having on zoning and land use, and if you can get some bipartisan agreement and get a bill done, he would enjoy signing that. And so I think that's an important piece. It's really interesting when you take a look at the number of states that have stepped into this space. It's red states and blue states, it's big states and small states, and they've stepped in different ways. And so, I think it's an important conversation for you all to have, even if I'm a bit in the bleachers on that one. I think the other thing is that we do look at the cost of housing, and we do everything that we can with the things that we invest in to try to think about the realities of costs going up, but also where is there an opportunity for cost efficiency. And we're looking at that all the time. It costs more to build a home today. What drives that is like 100 different things. And it's labor shortages, it's the cost of materials, depending on where you are, it could be tied to local preferences. There's just a ton of things that are driving the cost of housing. And so at a moment where we need more, the fact that it's harder to build is kind of the conundrum that we're in.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And here's an excellent opportunity for me to talk about my favorite example of the quadratic equation and how that was all of our favorite thing in high school and college algebra, but there are multiple integers that actually have to be solved independent of one another in order to get to the true answer. And many of my friends on the other side, as we talked about housing for the last 2 years, one of them is land use and zoning and some regulatory relief. One of them is other things that we're working on, and I'm grateful that you've shared that. And I really think that this is not a blue or a red thing. And as the commissioner stated, blue states, red states have all jumped into the deep end of the pool. And I think that that's really remarkable for us to sit here, and a lot of us have vastly different political, ideological perspectives on other things. Representative Kozlowski and I maybe agree on, 10, 12 things, but this is one of them. And I think that that's a really good opportunity for us to say, now is a time for us to come together and say, because 2 years ago we stuck our neck out for each other on a big bill. And I think that moved the needle a little bit. I think that we're looking at it in a more digestible piece so that we don't have the pig in a python. I think Representative Ray Rauer started laughing at the pig in the python a little bit. I saw her write that down. I'm going to use that later. But I think that it's a remarkable thing that you have people who are as vastly politically different on many other spectrums here to say, I'm willing to solve my part of the quadratic equation, because my kids, your kids, grandkids, whatever, need a place to call home, and it's incumbent upon us to get this fixed. So thanks for being here.
Thank you, Representative Nash. I think next on the list is Vice Chair Dotseff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Howell, appreciate you being here again today. It's always good to see you. This last slide we reviewed, you were actually discussing the increase of rents. And the question I've got is, we've looked at the burden put on our housing providers with the uptick in taxes, property taxes, insurance, and just the cost of repairs. What viable options do we have out there to help maybe take some of that pressure off of the housing providers as we move forward as well?
Commissioner.
Chair and Vice Chair, thanks for the question. A couple things, and one is that we made some investments in 2023 and 2024 together that have helped with some of those pressures. In 2023, we did the Stable Housing Organizational Relief Program, which was available to organizations that had rental portfolios of a certain size in order just to provide some relief for with a lot of flexibility in terms of how it was used. I know those funds were deeply, 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 deeply needed by the organizations that got them, and there's a great sense that they really had a high impact in helping them weather this piece. And then we also created this recapitalization program for distressed properties last session that we're in the process of standing up now. This is an opportunity for a building that was financed, say, a decade ago with a set of underwriting assumptions that made sense a decade ago, but the operating realities today are very different. And so can they have the organizations that have debt in those buildings agree to a different set of terms? Kind of like if you refinance your house, but really to do it to respond to the operating conditions that folks are seeing right now. So we are very much in dialogue, at least with the folks who do the targeted, affordable rental housing, with the impact of those changes and what we can do to kind of reset the way that their debt is structured if they have debt on the buildings.
Thank you, Commissioner. Vice Chair Dotseth, any follow-up?
Oh, thank you.
All right, next on our list will be Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I'm going to go back to the page 28 here and against the slide because it piqued my interest a little bit in the fact that I'm going to bring back to that was at the time that I was county commissioner, and we were helping the state distribute rental assistance to keep people in their apartments or to also help the landlords. And one of the interesting things that I found at that time, and it kind of leads up to the question, is that while builders were having trouble getting material, and thus they weren't building, the huge amount of money that was going out to renters was actually creating buyers. And so the question because what's happening, and I was also a contractor working with people who were going into homes, and I do a duct cleaning, so we get a lot of call when people first buy their home. And the amount of people that were moving into new homes was like an unbelievable level. We're just like, where are all these people coming from? Where are they getting the money to do it? And what I was being told by builders over and over again and realtors is that renters were taking the money for rental assistance, not passing on to the landlords, hoarding it for a number of months, getting their down payment, and then making a down payment on their homes. So I just think it's interesting. So then it goes back to how much does policy affect the prices of homes? You know, we sit here and we talk about trying to figure out how to make homes more affordable. Has anything, any study been done as far as for every $1 million we put out, we make homes that much less affordable because there you have that many more people buying them, you're increasing more demand, you're creating more expensive homes. So, you know, I just look at this and say change of gross rent, change in income. But during that 2019 and 22 period, we were the busiest we had ever been with people moving into new homes and wanting the duct cleaning done at that time. And the question was, where are they getting the money? And overall, this continual answer was received rental assistance, received COVID funds. We now have enough money for a down payment into the homes, which was then creating more demand, which was then increasing the pricing, which are things that we're never going to be able to fix because what happened is it raised prices $30,000, $40,000. How are you going to fix that when somebody has $40,000 more invested into a home and they're not going to sell? So I'm just wondering, is there any correlation that has ever been done that, you know, the support, which, you know, I'm not arguing that support, creates the opposite hope that you want to happen, if that's making sense with the question at all.
Commissioner?
Chair and Representative Johnson, thank you for that. Dakota County, is that where you were?
Washington.
Washington County, sorry about that. The state ran a huge federally funded pandemic rental relief program, and we cut checks to the property owner. So we weren't paying the resident to pay their landlord. We cut the check directly to the landlord. So I think in the program that we ran at the state, that scenario wouldn't have been possible. because it went to rent arrears for the landlord. I mean, I know there were other forms of stimulus money that were available, but I can just guarantee you that for the emergency rental assistance, Rent Help MN is the program that the state ran, that that the checks were either deposited into the landlord's account or a check was written to the LLC that, that ran the property. You know, I during the pandemic, home buying defied gravity. It was completely not my guess that home sales would have done what they did, that people would buy without, you know, when I first bought a house, you know, you spent, you know, Sunday afternoon, you just spent Sunday afternoon in your car, you know, and you went places, and like the whole way in which people bought homes completely changed during the pandemic in ways that I think kind of, like, as I said, defied gravity. We saw that with the agency lending. You know, we hit $1 billion during the pandemic. It was the highest level of lending that we'd ever done, and it was actually persisted at that level for the last few years since. So, I, you know, what I can assure you is that where we used emergency rental assistance, it went to pay past due rent. But we also have been perplexed by how it is that home buying kind of continued at this pace, you know, through this period of time.
Representative Johnson, you had some follow-up.
Just a quick follow-up. So if maybe I'm not remembering correctly, but I know the state sent a lot of money to the counties because the money wasn't getting out because of politics left and right. We got a lot of money for both businesses and rental to get out to people quicker, and we went through a number of it. And so we were actually had a rental program that was actually funded from the state. Maybe I'm misremembering it, but I remember it was a big deal at the time because we spent it and we actually came back for more at that time. But so you're saying the – so I guess my question is these landlords that are coming to us and saying they weren't getting the money and they were having trouble paying their mortgage because of the renters – not paying them, that couldn't have happened because you said the money went directly to the landlords?
Commissioner.
Just, and I'm working on the habit of protocol. It takes me a while to get my muscles back. Chair and Representative Johnson, I know that the federal government, when they distributed the COVID-19 emergency rental assistance programs, they gave money directly to jurisdictions over a certain size. And then they gave money to the state to run a statewide program. So Minneapolis, St. Paul, and the seven metro counties got their own direct allocation from the feds that did not flow through the state. And then the state had a separate money that came from the federal government, from both the original emergency rental assistance program and then a second phase. And then the state, and I don't know which local jurisdictions, also benefited from states that did not spend all of their emergency rental assistance. So we actually got more money from states that were underutilized that we were able to put out into our program. But we did have parallel programs operating for a while between the local jurisdictions that got a direct allocation from the feds and the program that we were running statewide. But again, you know, at a individual property owner level, they might know they got federal emergency rental assistance, but they may not know who was the administrator of it. Was it the city program, the county program, or the state program? They just know that they got it. Did everybody get it for all of their renters who were past due? I'm sure not. It really required a partnership between the renter who was behind and the property that was due the funds. They needed to work together to complete an application to get the funds. And in some cases, that wasn't possible. And so I don't want to make a blanket statement that everybody got the relief that they needed. But boy, we put hundreds of millions of dollars out the door in order to help what was a really significant challenge for folks at the time, both on the property side as well as on the renter side.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. I think that really outlines, too, you mentioned in your presentation, and members already kind of brought up just how diverse the housing issue really is, right? You're talking about pots of money that are flowing through multiple different places at once, and I think that is on us as committee members to really, you know, dive in here as we think about policy moving forward this year and next year about how every little action we make has a lot of cause and effect. So with that, next person on the list is Representative Hiltzley.
Thank you so much, Chair. Commissioner Holt, nice to meet you. So I have a couple questions, and don't mind me if I'm asking interesting questions because I'm still getting used to all of this. So I truly believe that housing is basically the staple of a thriving community. If you have stable housing, accessible housing, affordable housing, we have thriving communities. So my question for you is rooted in a situation right now is happening in my district. So how does the agency ensure that the state-funded housing developments remains affordable long-term, and what safeguards are in place to prevent displacement? And the reason why I ask that is because, as you probably know, Huntington is in my district. Yes, you're smiling. Yeah. And so I know that, you know, obviously that was a part of your 2023 legislative grant. And obviously there's conversations around it being sold. And I'm concerned about, obviously, the 800-plus family units that are in that development. So,
Commissioner.
Here I go, Representative Hiltzley, nice to meet you too. And I've had the opportunity to know a great deal about Huntington Place. For folks that don't know, this is one of the largest complexes of what they call naturally occurring affordable housing, which is a phrase I find to be very odd. But what it means is that it's rental housing that is below market rent.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have some type of government subsidy that it agreed to at that rent level. And it was a property that was owned by Dominium and bought by Aon several years ago. And it's had a lot of challenges for multiple reasons. In 2023, the legislature invested in a community stabilization program at the agency, which was really targeted towards how do we keep this so-called naturally occurring affordable housing affordable. And it included a legislatively named grantee for Huntington Place for Aon to kind of help it immediately with its financing. I think the, you know, as the ownership and financing of the building is restructured, I think the question is whether or not any terms of any of the funding will include land use restrictions that perpetuate the affordability over time. It is a new space to be for us to be working in the space of stuff that isn't otherwise rent controlled or government. When I use the word rent control, I mean that you agreed to a formula around rents in exchange for the flavor of money that you got from the state and federal or local government to be able to build or acquire the housing. So I think what you'll find with most of what we do, it either has low-income housing tax credits, it's got some other federal form of funding, it's got some state form of funding, and the quid pro quo to get that funding is to agree to tie rents to some level of affordability, usually tied to area median income. Targeted rents that would be affordable to somebody who makes 60% of area median income, rents targeted to people who make 50% of area median income. But this space in the middle where you have unsubsidized, unregulated private market housing that's below market rent, I think this is a new experiment for us to figure out if we make investments in the preservation of that housing, how do those investments keep the housing affordable? And I think that's just going to be an ongoing conversation. Huntington is probably on the leading edge because it is the largest NOAA acquisition and because, therefore, it has been the greatest one to challenge in terms of thinking about how do we organize the financing in such a way that is viable going forward.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Representative.
Yeah.
If that's okay, Chair.
Yes,
can
absolutely.
I ask a couple? Yeah. So in line with that, do you by any chance have a role? Does the agency have a role in addressing the backlog of repairs in some of this units, in some of this developments? Because again, the reason why I ask that, that's what I get all the time. Like, we have been sitting here waiting for, you know, repairs to be made. Does your agency have a role to play in that at all?
Commissioner.
Chair, Representative, it depends. And it really is around when we invest the money that the legislature intended for naturally occurring affordable housing, what is the, you know, who gets it? It's not enough money to solve all the housing needs. With the legislatively named grant that went to Huntington Place, I mean, it was a small part of solving a big challenge. And so with that legislatively named grantee, there wasn't the expectation that that money could fix everything that needed fixing at Huntington Place. Yeah. Do we have a role? I wish I had access to an unlimited supply of capital.
Of course.
But I don't. And so, you know, sadly, you know, there's winners and losers in what we invest in. Where we invest, we try to be really good stewards of the public resources that are, you know, so desperately needed and leverage our investment to get the most benefit for low-income families while also having operating budgets that are viable so that the folks that are willing to do this work will continue to do this work.
Awesome.
It's been complicated on a lot of fronts lately because of all the factors, and the showcase for complexity is Huntington Place.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Yeah. Representative.
And one more. Thank you, Chair. Yeah. One more question for you, and then I'll be done. Does the agency, or from your perspective, what's your take on leveraging private versus public partnerships to expand affordable housing options while ensuring public dollars that are being used, public dollars are used effectively? So the private versus public partnerships.
Commissioner.
Thank you. Chair and Representative, you know, housing, what we call affordable housing, has always been a public-private partnership. You know, there's some purely public housing that public housing authorities largely operate, and there's, you know, a ton. The vast majority of our housing market is purely private market, but like the low-income housing tax credit, for example, the largest source of federal capital for financing of housing is completely a public-private partnership. You've got private investors that are creating the capital stream for a private developer to be able to create units, and then it's kind of got a government-regulated overlay for the public benefit. To me, housing is the best space to really talk about leveraging private investments in order to get the best public benefit that we can in the ecosystem. Another place that happens is over here with the bank. I mean, we're working in the bond market to issue bonds, so we're getting private investors who are buying bonds that allow us to finance first-time homebuyer mortgages. So it's a great public-private partnership in order to create more pathways to home ownership for first-time homebuyers.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any more follow-up, Representative Hiltzley? All right, awesome, absolutely. Next on the list will be Representative Norris.
Thanks, Chair Igo, and good to see you, Commissioner. You know, looking back at that slide that, you know, kind of highlighted some of the challenges in terms of getting funding out for those new programs that were approved during the last biennium, you know, just thinking about the things that are within my purview, you know, the funding for schools to build affordable housing after some early hangups, you know, we were able to figure out a pretty innovative solution. So, you know, appreciate the ingenuity on that one. You know, some of the other things kind of in my portfolio around manufactured housing, it's been a little bit slower, more challenges. And so I guess, you know, trying to reflect on that, you know, What are some things that we as a legislature can do to, you know, help get these programs up and running more quickly so we can get the money out into the hands of the people who can deploy it more quickly? You know, one of the answers to that obviously would be, well, you know, just give us less work to do. But, you know, I think when we've seen from the presentation today, there's so many needs, such a varied set of needs that, you know, there's going to be a need for new programs. So going back to our pig in a python analogy, you know, how do we, rather than shrinking the size of the pig, what can we do to speed up the digestive process to move that pig through the python more quickly?
Well, before a bigger python might be needed, but we'll go to Commissioner.
Here I go, Representative Norris. Now I've got jaws in my head. We're going to need a bigger python. I say this with deep respect for what we were doing in 2023, and I think Representative Howard will have my back on this, but the agency was pretty consistent all through 2023 that where you put money into existing programs, we'll be able to get it out faster. And that is absolutely the case, that where you put more money into existing programs, the vast majority of that is already matched projects. So it's where we were doing something that we had to do from scratch, or with like the Greater Minnesota housing infrastructure dollars, where we were being asked to do something we had never done before. We always came in with housing financing after somebody else had worried about the roads and sewers, right? And then we were given a program to do roads and sewers, and we said, please give that to Deed. And Deed said, please give that to Minnesota Housing. And so we got a program to do roads and sewers with a team of people that have never done roads and sewers before. You know, the work that you led for schools to be eligible for Challenge, that was actually putting it into an existing program, which is great. But it was with eligible recipients who we hadn't never worked with before. And so we were able to match in the last round of single family some dollars out for a couple school districts, but we carved out a little bit of money to do something just for school districts because the school districts weren't like our typical developer, so our process was complex for them. And so we're trying to figure out how to meet your intention with the eligibility to be able to make it easier for the schools that are doing this job training and home building work to be able to get access to that type of money. I would say that our processes, by and large, for our core programs are built for speed. The fact that I don't wait until you're done with session before I issue my annual RFP, instead we just have our proposals due in July when we know how session has resolved itself. And that means that by December, I'm already making selections in our largest programs. And like I said, even when there was the anomaly of the October bonding bill surprise, we were able to take what got done in October and match it to projects in December. So in many ways, our existing programs are built for speed. The complexity was in column two and column three, where everything required building something from scratch. To build something from scratch, I need people. I need conversations with the stakeholders to make sure that we're translating the legislation and the intent. I need to write a program guide. I need to issue an RFP. I need to run a competitive process and make selections. I couldn't materialize people all at once. I mean, procurement and hiring are probably the two hardest processes of state government. So if you can find a way to make procurement and hiring easier, it seems like in some ways procurement has gotten harder because of the desire to make sure that we are checking a lot of boxes before we decide where money goes. So procurement has gotten harder, not easier, in terms of that process. And I've added a lot of new staff. When I started, I think we had around 250 staff. We now have about over 300 staff. But, I've had some staff positions that we have posted, and we just couldn't find a qualified person who applied for the job, so we reposted. And then I made an offer to somebody who got a better offer to go work for a private developer somewhere. So then I reposted. So some of this process is just what I'd say I've worked in the private sector. I've run a nonprofit. I've worked for United Healthcare. At United Healthcare, we saw talent. We just hired them. We built the bench. We literally used that phrase. Well, that person's great. Let's build the bench. I played basketball. I love that phrase. Everybody wants a strong bench. In government, we don't build the bench. And finding people that want to work at a state salary, I feel like we pay well, but I don't pay as well as a private developer. In many instances, I don't pay as well as a city or a county. I don't pay as well as a bank. So a lot of the people who work for my agency can get a higher paying job in the private sector. And good for them, if they do. And hopefully they'll bring all the knowledge that they learned working in government, you know, to that, and kind of a deep understanding of the importance of the role that we play. But 2023, the number of new programs and the number of legislatively named grantees, that was not built for speed. And they're all good programs. Every single, we didn't approve a single thing that wasn't good. But it's just hard to do that much new all at once. And honestly, in the grand scheme of how I felt in June of 2023 and what we've actually gotten done, you know, to this point in time, I feel like we've you know, moved three quarters of a mountain, which is pretty extraordinary. I think we're right around 72% of the funding from 2023 has been matched to a project, if not spent.
Representative Norris, any follow-up?
Thank you, Chair Igo, and thank you, Commissioner. That actually was a really helpful answer. I guess your one question or a narrower set of new programs were things that were pass-through, where we were, you know, MHFA was essentially a pass-through entity to get the money to other entities. So you're not having to necessarily hire new people, you know, not necessarily having to do, you know, a lot of different procurement. Are there things we can do to speed up those pass-through programs or grants in the future?
Commissioner.
Chair and Representative Norris, pass-through isn't as easy as it sounds because we still have an oversight obligation. So oftentimes on a pass-through program, I still need to hire staff. I don't need to write a program guide, and I don't need to do a competitive RFP if it's a legislatively named grantee. That does save a lot of time. But my obligation to have oversight of the funds being spent correctly and having oversight of that continues for the life of the grant. And the life of the grant can be as long as 5 years. So let's say it takes a year for the person who got the money to stand up the program, takes 5 years to run the program, and then we're going to have to, you know, close out the program. A pass-through could require 7 years of a staff person's time. Maybe it's a staff person who's helping monitor four of those programs. Just the fact that they're named doesn't mean we just write the check and thank you for your service. There's a whole piece of oversight that comes with that extends over a long period of time.
Thank you. And we have one more question from Representative Rehrauer.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. I think will be a short question for you. So I was on the Coon Rapids City Council the last 4 years, and my county, Anoka County, came and presented to us about the rising cost of housing. And they really talked about, for them, the biggest reason was a shortage that we currently have of 100,000 units of housing in the state. They also talked about the county and city level. But at the state level, would you agree that one of the biggest reasons that the cost of housing is so high, understanding it's complex and there's many factors, is that we don't have enough supply to keep up with the demand and there is a shortage of units in the state?
Chair and Representative Rehrauer, did I say that right?
Rehrauer,
thank you. Supply is the number one issue. And yes, yeah, estimates vary, but somewhere between 60 and 100,000 units, just shortage. But the separate from that is just units then that are affordable to households that make least. And that is where the shortage is the greatest. If you make more money, right, you shouldn't have to buy a more expensive home, right? So we're not trying to get everybody to spend, you know, 30% of their income or less on a home. You know, the way we get ahead is that if we can get our housing costs to be fixed and we actually, you know, start making more money, right? That's how we get ahead. But the supply of units that are affordable to people making 30% of area median income or less is where the shortage is the greatest. And a lot of the units that exist today that are affordable at that level are occupied by somebody who makes more than that, as they should be.
Thank you. Any follow-up, Representative? Okay. Well, then with that, we should get into the most important part of your presentation, the budget part. So thank you, members, for the questions, and Commissioner, thank you for the responses.
I just want to check, Chair. What's our hard out time? I think I want to.
We have a half hour left.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just want to pace myself accordingly. I'm going to pick up the speed.
Yes, yeah, I was going to say, yeah, if we could go through that, because I'm sure there'll be a few questions on budget, and then we'll. Yeah.
And if folks want to slow me down, tap the brakes. Okay. Okay. Just to put 2023 in perspective is this very simple bar graph. We came into the 2023 session with $115 million in our base. We walked out with $1.3 billion with a B, and we walk into this session with a base that's grown to $165 million. A couple of the things that were done to the base in 2023. The vast majority of things were done in one-time funding. I have, so 2023 obviously was very, you know, historic, unprecedented, all these words that I feel like I'm using all the time now, but just wanted to put that in perspective. As we think about our budget, we think about it in four buckets. What do we do that preserves and creates more homes? What do we do that increases housing stability? How do we support and strengthen home ownership? And how do we build and support organizational capacity for the folks who do this work? So if you take a look at that $165,600,000 that's in our base, this is the way it splits out across those four buckets. Now I'm going to do it. This is a pictorial version of resources. It used to be that about half of what we did were capital resources to build and produce. Coming out of the 2023 session, we now have only about a third of our budget that's used for capital and about two-thirds, well, 64% that is for housing stability, largely because bring it home rental assistance falls into the housing stability bucket and not the capital resources bucket. The one thing that isn't included on this stuff is stuff that you did in 2023 that wasn't appropriations. So there's also direct aid through the statewide and local affordable housing aid and the bring it home metro vouchers that are paid for through the sales tax. So if you take a look, then another way of thinking about our 2026-27 base budget, which is the governor's starting position is to hold the base, is to see the various line items, and this is kind of the core ongoing programs that we have today. And I'm going to hit these bucket program by program, bucket by bucket. So preserve and create new homes. These are the programs, the line items that fall underneath it. What these appropriations allow us to do is to leverage funding from other sources and to do either grants or 0% deferred loans oftentimes in order to create and preserve housing that's targeted to Minnesotans who make the least. And these lines are largely funded through our annual consolidated RFP process, although a couple of them are done in standalone processes. Challenge is really kind of the workhorse of our programs. One of the things that I love about Challenge is that it allows us to work with for-profit and nonprofit developers and local units of government. It's got flexibility for communities to identify what their housing needs are. It can be used for both rental and home ownership, and it's highly leveraged. And take a look at the green box in the bottom and give you a sense of who's there. This is a photograph from a Habitat Project in Winona, and love getting out there when we're cutting ribbons with big scissors. The Workforce Home Ownership Program, this is really used for a development cost, rehab, land development, affordability gap, and get a sense of the funding. We did 36 proposals are what was funded in the last round. We had a lot of money, one-time money in 2023 for that, but when you come back to our base, the base is just $500,000 a year. And obviously the fact that we were able to do $41 million worth of investment and still probably said no to some other proposals just gives you a sense of how oversubscribed the base budget of this program is. The Greater Minnesota Workforce Housing Program, this is a wildly popular program for employers, cities, and developers all across the state in Greater Minnesota. It's specifically targeted to support business growth in Greater Minnesota. And the vast majority of developments are in communities with populations of 5,000 or less. This map shows the 2024 selections. That was 38 million to 27 projects, but we got 99 million in applications that year. So just a sense of where the need is there. Manufactured home community infrastructure grants. This is the paving of roads of the manufactured home community down in Richfield. But this is like really a basic health and safety needs of a manufactured home community. We have places that have broken sewer lines. They have sewer seepage. We have places that have undrinkable brown water. So not only do they have to buy water to drink, but it's actually rusting out their appliances and their, you know, the infrastructure of the home. And this also can be used for the residents of a manufactured home community to purchase and become a cooperative owner of their manufactured home community, which is a number of communities that I've visited is very exciting to watch the residents take on governance of their own communities. But the base for this is $2 million, and you take a look at what we were able to do in 2023, you know, there's a lot more need out there than what we're able to fund. The rental rehab loans is really a unique program that targets Greater Minnesota housing. A lot of it was built by, funded by the U.S. Department of Agriculture Rural Development Programs. These are private builders and property owners that use that USDA money to create housing that had built-in federal subsidy from USDA. There are over 9,000 of these units, and about 2,000 of them have a mortgage with USDA that's set to mature in the next 10 years. And we really don't want to lose that housing to the private market, and we really don't want to lose that access to federal rental assistance that keeps it affordable. I recently had the opportunity to go celebrate Southwest Minnesota Housing Partnership, did an acquisition of 10 of these rural housing projects from a private developer who was retiring. So he had done this over the course of his work career, but he was ready to sell. And he could have sold to the private market, but he opted to sell to a nonprofit in order to keep these properties in 10 different communities affordable to their residents. The PARIF program, this is the Preservation Fund. This is another way that we keep federally rent-assisted properties from HUD and from USDA affordable in communities. And you get a sense of the extremely low income of the households who live in these types of properties. The single-family rehab loan programs, this is a 0% loan to make up to $37,500 of home improvements in owner-occupied housing. So how do we help, for example, an aging senior stay in their home? How is it that we help a low-income family replace the roof? These are opportunities to do some really important health, safety, accessibility, and energy-efficient investments at terms that a household can afford. Next bucket, what we call the housing stability bucket. These are the line items that are in the bucket, and I'll go through each of them in turn. Bring It Home is the campaign that created the new line item for rental assistance in the state. And so we are working very closely with the organizations that today administer HUD housing choice vouchers to figure out how do we stand up a lookalike or a modified version of that funded through state resources. You know, only one in four households who is income eligible for a HUD housing choice voucher actually gets one. I think it's one of the few federally means-tested programs where if you're eligible, you don't get it necessarily. So what the Bring It Home rental assistance vouchers are going to do is to increase access for up to 5,000 renting households. It's really up to the local housing authority to make the decision about whether they're going to project-base that rental assistance or have somebody carry it as a voucher into the private market. What the legislature said is we want it to be targeted to renters at or below 50% of area median income. with a priority for folks that are at 30% of area median income, and you ask that it be targeted to households with children. I think the thing that's been complicated about building this is that the whole housing choice voucher system is operated on an IT system that's connected to HUD. And so how do we figure out how to have a parallel way to get money out and collect the information that's needed to make sure that it's serving the folks that we intended? The Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program was really designed to help keep families from becoming homeless, or if families become homeless, to try to get them back into housing as quickly as possible. There have been huge infusions into the Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program over the last couple of years, complemented by the large investments that were made with the federal COVID emergency rental assistance programs. So when we come back to the base of 20 million, this is actually a pretty big cliff for Minnesotans and for the providers who operate these programs, because I think it's fair to say we've had, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of emergency assistance available the last couple of years for this. So when the 2024 new investment is done and we return to base, I think we're going to feel that across the state. The Housing Trust Fund is a program that we operate in partnership with folks that provide housing to very low-income families in the form of operating subsidies. You know, I think it's important to note that nearly three-quarters of the people who are helped by this program are people who have experienced long periods of homelessness, and about half are families with kids. And again, you take a look at the median income of the households who have served on this, it's extremely low income. Homework Starts with Home is a program that was created kind of as a pairing of Family Homeless Prevention and Housing Trust Fund dollars, and it really was set up to be kind of a pairing of school districts with organizations that are capable of helping families prevent or quickly resolve their homelessness. You know, one of the things that the early research showed here is that when people have stable housing and they're not worried about funding for their rent, the households are able to actually grow their incomes, which is a great outcome then. Again, though, extremely low-income folks that are being served by the program. Bridges is so named because it was created to be a bridge to Section 8 housing choice vouchers when it was first created. It's a very long bridge because Section 8 housing choice vouchers aren't readily available for folks. But it was really targeted for folks with a serious mental illness, in large part to keep folks out of hospitals and regional treatment centers. It's really an important program in terms of just the stability of the folks that are a part of it. I have the honor of chairing the Olmstead subcabinet. Olmstead was the Supreme Court case that said that people with disabilities have the right to live in the most integrated settings in communities of their choice. Bridges is one way that we are able to do that. Next bucket. Support and strengthen home ownership. Two key base programs here. Again, 1.8 million in the base is a very, very, very small portion of what the agency does, because we kind of take the earnings on mortgages that home buyers are paying, and we reinvest the earnings on that back into down payment assistance for the next homeowner. And then again, we had the infusion. The agency had $50 million of one-time first-generation down payment assistance money, and that's all gone. So, you know, down payment assistance is an area of great need and great success. And again, an area where when the 2023 investments are gone, you know, what happens after that? The homeownership education, counseling, and training, I think I mentioned this earlier, this is just really helping people understand how to get their credit score in a good place to qualify for a mortgage. What does it mean? I'll always remember the scariest day of my life signing all those documents for a 30-year commitment. So help people kind of get ready for that, especially if they're folks that didn't grow up in a house where their parents owned a home. It can be kind of a mysterious process. And so that's a small but important investment. And then building a supporting organizational capacity is just really helping make sure that organizations can really have what it takes to be able to compete for and administer state assistance. The last thing I just want to mention is that we've consistently over the years done geobonding for public housing preservation. There will be $7 million in the governor's recommendation, which I guess I'm allowed to tell you today. Okay, great. The intent to apply for the upcoming RFP, we had 58 responses with $103 million of needed repairs. And oftentimes, like, these are like really, really needed repairs. We always get photos in with applications, and it's amazing when you take a look at the HVAC or the plumbing or the elevator or just the state of deterioration in a parking lot and sidewalks. I think about, you know, grandma walking across that icy parking lot, and it makes me very scared. So these public housing investments are really important. The federal government built these, but they didn't keep up on their commitment to maintain them. And so for them to be preserved as the kind of critical asset that they are in communities all across the state, those investments are really important. That's the last of my slides. What I would say in closing is that we have a good partnership, what we do together. And, 2023, we get it. I mean, that was very different than 2024, and here we are in a very different 2025. But I think it's important to know that the investments made in 2023 haven't all made it into, converted into homes. We're going to still see the benefit of that. But even with that, the need has always been greater than even what we knew we were investing in 2023. So I really look forward to partnering you to figure out how we get the best result that we can from this legislative session. And as I always like to say, I'm happy to take any questions, but save all the hard ones for Dan.
Thank you, Commissioner. And I think, so we're kind of running tight on time. I know we have one question to start from Representative Igbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Ho. Always good to see you again and your team. This is a really great presentation about the overview of like the whole, all the work that you guys do. I think one question I just have in general is, we did put in a lot of one-time funding last cycle. And it's kind of jarring to see that we started at like around 115 million, went up to over a billion, and then are now back down at 165 million when we have very clearly stated that the need is there. And so I guess my question kind of to you guys is kind of thinking about how concerned are we, that we're just not going to be able to meet this need? And then what are the ways that we can start to think creatively, particularly with the programs that will still be coming online, but also with any type of dollars that we might be able to find or squeeze out or something, just how to think creatively about where to best ensure that people can have a good outcome for their housing.
Commissioner.
Chair, I go, Representative Igbaje. I mean, I'm very concerned. Doesn't matter where I travel in the state, a manufactured home community, a homeless shelter, sitting with a mayor or a county commissioner, sitting with a business leader, there is nobody. I mean, obviously, I'm the housing commissioner, so of course we're going to talk about housing when I show up. But there's nobody that is saying to me, we don't need what you do here. And, all of our programs are oversubscribed. There's more need out there. And, we are just a small part of the whole housing ecosystem. But we need a sustained lift over time if we're going to get the home ownership market back in balance and if we're going to get the rental market to work for more renters. And we're just a long ways away from that. And I don't have any magic wands. I mean, I think what we try to do is make sure that we're having the highest impact with the dollars that you invest in us and we invest in back into your communities. This is a big problem, and I think one of the things that concerns me most, and like I said, I started out in healthcare. I mean, it was a no-brainer to me when people who were advocating for housing for people who are homeless came and said to me, hey, Blue Cross person, you have a Medicaid member who's homeless. I knew my case management system down in Eagan was not designed to solve that problem, right? And it wasn't that hard for me to understand that a person who was homeless, who was also sick, was getting care in the most expensive settings, which is exactly where I didn't want them to get care, right? And that when they were housed, that it turned out that folks stopped getting care in the most expensive setting, and they started going to the doctor and taking their medicine. And that's exactly what we wanted. You know, we know a family that's highly mobile is creating school mobility, and that's not good if a kid starts and ends the school year in a different school district every year. You know, we know that this is, I got employers in greater Minnesota saying, you know, I want to expand our capacity, but I can't get workers, you know, because they can't find a place to live within a reasonable driving distance from the job. And so I guess the concern I have, and I think we saw this with inflation over the last stretch of time. I mean, housing costs were a big driver of what was causing inflation. And so, we have a supply problem, and because we have a supply problem, we have a price problem. But that price problem is really a people problem. And I mean, one of my observations is it used to be somebody else's problem, but it's increasingly something that touches all of our lives. Whether it's a 20-something that, like, I thought you'd be gone by now, whether it's seniors who feel like they don't have an affordable option to get out of their house, you know, it's becoming an everyone everywhere problem as opposed to a problem over there for some people. And that's not just here. I mean, I had an opportunity to sit with Congressman Emmerich in Washington, D.C. to talk about the upcoming tax bill debate, because a lot of our federal resources are tied to what the fate of the tax bill, our ability to issue private activity bonds in a tax-exempt way, our ability to do the low-income housing tax credits. And so and that private activity bond almost disappeared in the tax debate 8 years ago. And so I asked the congressman, you know, what's different as we walk into the conversation today than 8 years ago? And he said, well, 8 years ago, housing wasn't a top priority for most congresspeople, but today it is. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think it's just become an everyone everywhere problem as opposed to some people over there problem. I hope we get some help in the tax bill, but I'm not holding my breath because we saw what they did 8 years ago where kind of in the final, I think 26 days or something of the debate, the private activity bond option just disappeared. And, like, you know, I wasn't in this role at the time, but, you know, I'm sure Commissioner Tingerthaw and others fought like heck to get it back in there. I mean, that's a huge part of the tools that we have to be able to do the work that we're doing. So I am I'm concerned that we've got a problem that we don't have a solution to, even though we know what to do. Mm-hmm. It's just about funding it at a scale that allows us to persist in order to close the shortage problem and therefore fix the price problem for people over time.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any follow-up, Representative? And we're kind of getting short on time, and I got a few more people to get.
Okay, so. Great. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say to the Commissioner, I appreciate you saying that. I think that concern is something that we all take seriously here. And so I'm hopeful that as we continue our efforts and our work together over the next, you know, this next session, that we can continue to make housing a number one priority, because I think it's the basis for everyone. So thank you again, Commissioner. Thank you, Chair.
Next on the list is Representative Hussein.
Thank you, Chair. Good to see you, Commissioner, and thanks for putting this wonderful presentation together. We've seen a lot of things that you have been targeting, and we do have when it comes to housing in the state of Minnesota, as we all know, we have a housing crisis, and we did phenomenal work, and we put a lot of funding for the last 2 years. And this year, we might not have the funding that we are targeted. What would you think, one thing that as a committee that we could work together to target, to address, to help you and help for our state of Minnesota? Is it housing? Is it homelessness? Is it like... I know we put a lot of funding, but what other, it would be your top priority if we squeeze it, you know, I'm just following up with Representative Obache's, what can we take away?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair Igo, and thank you, Representative Hussein. If I had a magic wand and I could have three wishes come true, one is that we've got a problem just with the health of the ecosystem. That the organizations that we rely on and adjust market conditions have made it challenging for the folks who want to do this mission-oriented work to do this work. And frankly, you know, there's some strains on the agency as well just because of the market conditions that are out there. So wish number one, invest in the health of the ecosystem. Two, I think that family homeless prevention is really, really important. If you think about who has the worst housing case, it's the person who doesn't have housing at all. And so what can we do to prevent it wherever we can, and what do we do to solve it in the instances where it happens? I think the other big opportunity this session is to talk about housing infrastructure bonds. They are just such a great engine of production and preservation. It's a unique tool that we've had. I think the challenge for this committee is going to be the question of whether it sits in capital investment or whether it sits in this committee. If it sits in this committee, then your targets need to accommodate the debt service on housing infrastructure bonds over time. If it gets over into capital investment, then this committee can talk about how great they are and not have to worry about the debt service on them. So I think what I would say is that I think those are the three, the three things that I'm focused on. And if I had that magic wand, boy, would I be waving it.
Thank you, Commissioner. And we'll go to Lead Howard now.
Thank you, Chair Ego, and thank you, Commissioner, and thank you to your agency and all their work over the last few years to implement Go Big. And it's refreshing to see the slide that almost all the resources are either committed or nearly committed. And to Representative Johnson's point earlier about, what is the resources doing to address our supply problem, but for these investments, the production of the kinds of single-family homes and homes to rent would not occur. Thousands of homes for Minnesotans helping us with that supply-demand mismatch. And so thank you to the agency for helping us get in moving in the right direction. I do have to say that I am disappointed that the governor's budget doesn't include a single dollar more in the base budget for housing. Given the housing shortage that we're up against and given the prioritization that I think we all see in need in this housing, that there's no increase in the base budget and no housing infrastructure bonds in the governor's budget is disappointing. And as we work together this session, I just think we all need to understand and work together both on the public investment and the policy side, find ways to get outside of the status quo, because the status quo is not meeting the moment for Minnesotans. And on the budget, for members that have been in housing, you've heard this analogy before and will probably roll your eyes, but for the benefit of new members, if our general fund house budget was was a jug of water, we spend less than a tablespoon on housing, less than a quarter of a percent. And so when you look at how critical housing is to everything in our lives, to spend a quarter of a percent on our state budget isn't meeting the moment, and I think part of why we're in this mess that we're in. And so this is a challenge to the governor. It's a challenge to all of us that we need to find ways to break free from the status quo this session to meet the moment that's facing Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, and thank you, Commissioner, and your team for being here today for this great presentation, vibrant discussion from our members. So just thank you again for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right, just closing agenda items. You'll be getting an overview of the rules sent out. Lead Howard and I discussed them, so those will be coming into your inboxes here shortly. And I think per this conversation we had today, I think there's been a lot of conversations about things we need to do. I challenge this committee to start diving into those things, but also with the realization that money is going to be hard, and I think we can all accept that. But we also need to know we can make money out of policy changes. And by finding ways to do policy, we can actually unleash capital in the state. So let's challenge ourselves to be looking into that, and let's bring some good bills to this committee and do a good thing. So with that, we are adjourned.